This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is The Known World. Over the years, I've done several podcasts on the subject of music. The very, very first was 4 years ago, even a little more, in which I looked at that very fundamental question, what do technical people do when the going gets tough? The answer in that case was retreat into programming. Go off and try to make your machine do something that it hasn't done before. In the case of that story, it was play Christmas carols. This is a very different podcast, written about a different age. It's asking the question, what happens when you make something manipulable by mechanical means? Its title is Finding What You Want. For years, I have had a steady relationship with three internet radio stations. They promoted interesting and engaging music that I enjoyed. One presented intellectually elitist classical music, another broadcast disdainfully cool jazz, and the third was devoted to completely incomprehensible avant-garde pop. No matter which station I chose, I felt that I was working with people I could trust, people who would provide me with the kind of music that I could use to shape my day. Last spring, all three stations began to falter. First, the classical station began an unstoppable drift towards short, bland pieces by unknown composers. Next, the jazz station took as its motto, global jazz for a global age, and demonstrated that its leaders had an unfortunate preference for songs that were hardly global and barely jazz. Their playlists slipped into that mushy world of major keys and slippery saxophones that provides more distraction than any real enjoyment. Finally, in a last desperate effort to retain the youth of today as part of its listening audience, finally, there was the failure of the pop station. In a desperate effort to retain the youth of today within its listening audience, that station embraced repetitious dance music. Each song had to fit into a little tight box that allowed no more than 7 minutes of music, 5 recognizable words, 2 chord changes, and, of course, 1 inflexible drum beat pounding away. Seeing no hope for improvement, I went in search of other internet radio stations. Finding little of interest, I took the advice of a friend and subscribed to Pandora, a music streaming service. It'll give you just the radio station that you would like, my friend said. It will give you a whole new relationship with music. Well, my first experience with the music streaming service was delightful. Pandora lets you build an internet radio station by combining one or more music streams. Each of these music streams is created by giving the software a target song that you already know and already like. The basic software will then feed music into your stream by identifying songs that are similar to that one that you have selected. It uses a pretty straightforward algorithm with a fairly ordinary distance metric. Within 10 minutes, I'd identified a couple of target songs and had a new internet radio station that I found, well, pleasant enough. I spent the morning listening to my new music source, and over lunch I took another look at the database. But in looking at that database, I made a discovery that led to trouble. Much to my delight, and it was an initial delight, I found that the system had an obscure record by a weird esoteric art band from my youth, a band that I adored. I'd not heard this record in ages. My original version is long since lost. So I selected my favorite tune from the record, added it to my collection, and waited for the streaming system to give me exactly what I wanted. It took less than 1 hour for my delight to sour into frustration and my pride of discovery to collapse into, well, embarrassment. Once more, I learned that esoteric knowledge should never be mistaken for good taste. My favorite song had aged badly. To my adult ears, it was nothing more than a silly and rather shallow ballad that appealed only to teenage boys who still believed in the promises of fantasy literature. Furthermore, it proved to be a complete singularity. It had no natural neighbors in Pandora. As a result, it became a regular fixture of my playlist. Every 15 to 18 minutes, Pandora would repeat that song as if it were determined to show me how pathetic my musical taste really, really was. The problem was easy enough to fix, of course, but its memory remained. I deleted the song, reset the stream. But this change resulted only in a slight improvement. As I listened to the edited stream, I began to realize that most of the songs were familiar derivatives of the original Target songs and really offered little new. Less than 3% of the active music titles account for over 80% of sales, the streaming service noted. The bulk of the day's music came from that unprofitable 97% of the music catalog, and most of it demonstrated an obvious lack of commercial and artistic value. I soon decided to abandon the service, dismissing it as a fad that would vanish from the cyber airwaves in a month or two. However, as I returned to my work and started playing a familiar MP3 file to fill the quiet of my office, I realized that I may have made a mistake in identifying Pandora as a new form of the radio station. Radio stations create community through their broadcasts. That community is carried from house to house to ship, from sail to train, wrote the playwright Bertolt Brecht. Last thing at night and first in the morning. Promise me not to go silent all of a sudden. In contrast, Pandora offers no community. It is a tool for exploring a set of objects in the vast reaches of musical space. Pandora's material referred to it as an effective means of browsing and discovering new music that we will like. If you look at this in the words of computer scientist Douglas Engelbart, Pandora is really a technology that augments our intellect, not one that forms a community. By augmenting human intellect, Engelbart wrote, we mean increasing the capacity of a single man. He wrote about men at those times, of a man, to approach a complex problem situation and to gain comprehension to suit his particular needs and to derive solutions to problems. Once I realized that Pandora was not a means for recreating the communities of my formerly favorite radio stations, I recognized the complex problem I was actually able to solve. I enjoyed hearing new music, but I was unwilling and really unable at this time of my life to invest large amounts of time and money to search for that music. I had limited time to attend concerts by unfamiliar artists and no patience, none at all, for pawing through alphabetical lists of songs, even when those songs had been categorized by some kind of genre and style. Pandora gave me a tool to find interesting music. It also required me to change my relationship not to community, but to music critics. Years and years ago, I accepted the opinion of guitarist Frank Zappa, in which he dismissed music critics as people who can't write, interviewing people who can't talk, for people who can't read. With Pandora, I found that I could completely ignore the literary failures of musical journalists and still profit from their experience. I could harness their judgments as input to Pandora and use that tool, the tool of Pandora, to explore musical space for me and identify interesting artists in genres that I did not know. I started then reading the literature, following a critic here, reading that one there, taking an idea, a band, funneling it into Pandora, and listening where it went. Following this strategy, I found this Mexican guitarist with absolutely stunning technique. I also found a British hip-hop duo, almost classic in nature given how long they've been with us, that were really quite surprisingly skilled with words. And last, this mixed voice Eastern European choir. I have no idea what they are singing about if you ask me to understand the words, but their sense of unity and togetherness and counterpoint will make your heart melt. As I began to understand how I might use Pandora, I was reminded of my first encounter with Engelbart's ideas for graphical interfaces, ideas that include the now very standard concepts of computer mice and icon and those other things that are part of the modern graphical user interface. That encounter had involved a system that had been written by a couple of computer technicians. It was an old mainframe. And they devised a system that represented the work that they had to do on that mainframe. They had developed these little teeny icons for the objects they handled, punched cards, for example, swapped disk drives, and the other elements of the third generation mainframe that was the center of their world. They had a mouse, and they used the mouse to move these objects from different parts of the computer to another, mount a file, take off a file, and pace themselves through the tasks of a typical day. They could read a deck of cards, punch a deck of cards, mount a disk, start a job, all of that stuff. In the process, they even went so far as to duplicate the failures of the physical objects that they were representing. A drop deck of cards. They had a little button that would drop it and shuffle it, for whatever good that did you. They had another one that dented a plate on a hard drive. It was a system that really didn't look through the complexity of problems, that didn't augment power and look for a better solution. It looked backwards, not forwards. Of course, the task of looking forward, even with the aid of a new technology, is in fact remarkably difficult. We don't see problems clearly or even define fundamental elements in the proper term. Pandora is an example of a concept known as a music information retrieval system. It even has an acronym, MIRS. At base, these systems are really just databases. Databases that allow individuals to make queries and retrieve objects. It's a jukebox. The jukebox is really an example of a crude version of such a system. It took a nickel, retrieved a song in response to a two-symbol code. Modern music retrieval systems utilize fairly well-known data structures and algorithms for storing and organizing their content. They're divided into two broad classes of systems. The first uses musical notation to organize information, and is really retrieving that information. The other uses some transformed version of audio data as the basis of its search and organization. While some, like Pandora, search descriptions of the songs in a metadata, the most interesting, at least interesting to me, search the music itself. Most can be designed to return perfect matches or near matches or genre matches. Some of the most impressive will take an ill-hummed melody, something that you or I might try to put into a microphone, and still return some kind of match from their databases. Now, we know to make such a system, we need a means of categorizing and organizing music. You can't start and do a search through a database of thousands of songs and do so starting at some random point at the beginning and ending at a similar one at the end. You have to have something that allows you to do a treed search, an organized search, some kind of binary look at your database. Now, historically, musicians and musicologists have really never used anything more than crude sets of categories to organize music. If you look at Ludwig von Kirchhoff, for example, Kirchhoff was the individual who set the basic standards for music catalogs in the 19th century when he created a catalog of Mozart's music in 1862. Kirchhoff listed the pieces chronologically. That is obvious, of course, and in many ways quite useful. It allows you to start with those pieces and operas and songs that Mozart wrote when he was 12. Amaze yourself at how good they were, and then march forward to see what he produces over the next 35 years. Kirchhoff kept little pieces of metadata that would allow you to sort through things a little easier. Key signatures, the types, you know, like sonata, symphony, opera, and so forth. But he also kept a little piece of musical data that allowed the reader to search. It was a few opening notes, stored in, obviously, notation, that's called the incipit. The readers of his catalog were encouraged to hum the incipit, if you are able to sight read. And from that, that might help you recognize and identify objects in his database. Kirchhoff's approach changed little during the 19th and early 20th centuries, though it was occasionally modified for certain kinds of music. Hymns, for example, when they were organized into databases, which were also called hymnals, were often organized and categorized by syllable counts, which was a way to allow singers to use new words with old hymns. You would count out the syllables in your new words, and you would go through your hymnal looking for hymns with the same number of syllables per line. The first efforts to find formal, mechanical methods for categorizing music really came when we moved from the idea of an oeuvre of a single composer to looking at a genre, particularly the genre of folk music. In the United States, the pioneering musicologist John Lomax was the one who started assembling collections of folk music and trying to find some kind of order for them. In 1911, Lomax could report that he had a catalog of well over 100 cowboy songs, as he called them, from the American Southwest. Some of these songs, he explained, I have from 5 to 20 slightly varying versions. However, he really had no formal means of describing the differences between these songs or organizing them around common themes. As an example of the scale of the challenge he faced, Lomax cited a single song that had expanded as it had passed from voice to voice. I know of one person who claims to be able to sing 143 stanzas of it, he noted. The creators of such songs had time in a way that Lomax did not. They were isolated in a vast land of the West, far from cities or books or magazines or anything else that would take their attention. It was perfectly natural, he wrote, for them to seek diversion in a song. Writing some 60 years later, Lomax's granddaughter the Lomax family became quite a group of musicologists and did a great deal to organize what we now think of as American folk music. Lomax's granddaughter suggested that the great diversity of folk music might forever prevent it from being archived in a simple, unified way. The classification problem suggested here is by no means a new one, she wrote, and it can simply be stated, is a song a function of its lexical content or is it social usage? Was the song best characterized as a lullaby because it was sung to drowsy babies or as a ballad because of its structure? Of course, as far as archiving goes, it doesn't really matter, she added. You pay your money, and you take your chances. Musicologists proved to be quite slow to embrace the methods of formal language theory and complexity analysis that computer scientists started to embrace in the late 1950s. This is true even though they had a field that had a fundamental form of notation, the musical staff. One of the early applications of formal theory to music came actually from the computer science community in a 1984 article by Don Knuth called The Complexity of Songs. This article is often considered a novelty paper, as it goes through the chorus-verse structure of songs and asks, how complex are they as algorithms? If you were to expand them following the basic rules of the song, how many new words would you have to add? What would you have to find to continue the song? And he goes through the standard chorus verse selection. He goes on through adding songs like the 12 Days of Christmas. And he goes through relatively repetitious structures like the old camp favorite 100 Bottles of Beer on the Wall. At least that one has a stopping rule. At the end of the paper, in its climatic part, he shows that there is a song that can be extended indefinitely with no new information, that it has all the information that it needs. And that was a hit of the time by a band called Casey and the Sunshine Band, called That's the Way I Like It. Knuth describes this as an arbitrarily long song of complexity big O of one. Because of that, it was looked on as a novelty paper. To put it in a more generous framework, it's really a paper about computer science techniques, analytical techniques, and it chooses an unusual way of expressing them. Musicologists at the time of this paper, in the early 1980s, were looking at formal methods, formal grammars, formal analytic techniques. But like Lomax's granddaughter, they were completely unsure of the value of such analyses, as these analyses did not seem to answer any questions that they considered. Formal grammars are only really interesting when they can be used to drive a model of human performance on a task that involves understanding, argued one musicologist. What task of musical understanding could use formal rules? He was trying to derive a formal grammar for jazz and could offer absolutely no reason for the value of his work. Sometimes we understand how technology can augment our abilities only after a crisis shows us the value of a new approach to a problem. Music information retrieval systems became a subject of serious study only with the great Napster crisis of 1999 to 2001, the two-year period in which a very simple peer-to-peer music retrieval system opened the canon of Western popular music without regard to the rights of authors or performers. Prior to 1999, neither the music literature nor the technical literature showed much interest in music information retrieval systems. You could find an occasional overview article in a general magazine in the field, and a couple of discussion of familiar algorithms and how they might be adapted to music information systems. But you could find no consistent thread, no body of knowledge in which one idea builds upon the next and shows a field a space which can be understood as a whole. Music information retrieval systems proved to be one of those topics that didn't fit well in existing technical fields, or musical fields, or analytic fields. To most researchers, it was nothing more than a clever example of some form of technology. It became a serious field of study only when a group of scholars identified such systems as tools that could simplify their work. These scholars were not computer scientists and they were not musicologists. They were librarians. In particular, they were researchers involved in the National Science Foundation Digital Library Initiative. It was a short happy tale, reported two individuals who helped to establish the field of music information retrieval systems. In the two-year period of the Great Napster Crisis, researchers in the field established a conference, began publishing technical articles, and developed a set of categories that described their work. This effort established a place for music information retrieval systems, though that place was not quite part of library science, nor really an aspect of computer science, and certainly not a branch of musicology. It proved to be a body of knowledge that allowed researchers to pay their money and take their chances, to sort through the work of others, and ultimately to find what they wanted. You've been listening to the Known World Podcast. This podcast is based on an essay that was published in the 2010 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. More about this podcast can be found at www.computer.org/theknownworld. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast, the last thing I have to tell you, came from the Music Alley PodSafe Network. You can find them at musicalley.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.